This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Pet rocks, Harvest Gold appliances, earth shoes, big hair, disco. Yes, on the program today, we're going to travel back in time to the 1970s. Our guide is writer and critic Thomas Hine, author of The Great Funk, Falling Apart and Coming Together on a Shag Rug in the 70s. While the 70s was a decade of shag carpeting and disco, it was also the decade that saw these events: Watergate and the resignation of Richard Nixon, the end of the war in Vietnam, the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade, the OPEC oil embargo. On the music scene, in addition to disco, there was punk rock. The Beatles broke up in 1970. The decade gave birth to the Hollywood blockbuster, so-called blaxploitation and kung fu movies. Television's offerings included All in the Family, The Jeffersons, Charlie's Angels, and Saturday Night Live. As the 70s drew to a close, we watched Ted Koppel covering the hostage crisis, the diplomatic crisis between Iran and the U.S. that began in 1979 and lasted for 444 days. Listeners, what are your thoughts about the 70s? We look forward to hearing from you this afternoon. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Thomas Hine. He writes on history, culture, and design. The Great Funk is his sixth book. His previous books include Populux. Hine coined that word to describe the styles and enthusiasms of post-World War II America. From 1973 to 1996, he was the architecture and design critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's also a frequent contributor to other publications. The Great Funk, Falling Apart and Coming Together on a Shag Rug in the 70s is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. You can find out more information about our guest and about his books at his website, Thomas Hine, and that's H-I-N-E, .com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Tom Hine, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, it's good to be on, Celeste.
What inspired you to look back at this decade, the decade of the 70s?
Well, as you just mentioned, the first of my six books, was called Populux, which was about the look and life of America in the 50s and 60s. And this one of the reasons for that I wrote Populux was to talk about what an extraordinary period and how different it was from the late 80s when I wrote Populux. And ever since then, people have been saying to me, hey, what happened? And hey, aren't you going to do another book that's as much fun as Populux?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I resisted that for a long time, but I had always thought that the era, the decade that truly undid the 50s wasn't the 60s, but the 70s, because that's when the kind of culture, counterculture became the culture.
Yeah. Well, The Great Funk is a lot of fun. It's also, though, very thoughtful, and one of the things you say in the book is that this is not meant to be an indulgence in nostalgia. So what can we learn by looking back to this decade?
Well, I think that one of the things I think right now we can learn quite a number of things, because we actually are facing once again many of the problems that we were facing during the 70s of global warming, of environmental crises and so forth, that we sort of solved a little bit in the 70s and basically then put out of our minds for the next couple of decades. One of the great things about the 70s that I think is that we could learn is how much freedom one can get once one accepts that a course of action has failed. That what gave the 70s its creativity was this idea that the kind of big technology, big government, big science, big unions, big everything, was going to solve everybody's problems, and people could just sit in their backyards and not worry about anything. That suddenly what happened is that there was this sense that the life that people had expected to happen wasn't happening, that we had the failure of the political system to some degree, was certainly exposed through the Watergate scandals. We had the failure of the political system also exposed through the kind of ignominious end to the Vietnam War. And this failure proved to be liberating. It gave people, you know, that on a personal level, that there wasn't only one way to have a career, that you could be on your own, you could be entrepreneurial, you could be following your passions and coming up with things like the personal computer, or you didn't have to have a family if you're, you know, that it wasn't possible, you know, there was no place for gays, say, in the world of the 50s, and suddenly there was. The idea of what's the proper role of a wife and a mother, as opposed to the possibilities of being a woman, that really changed during the 1970s.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking now of television, and I'm thinking of in terms of the sitcoms that we saw. We saw Mary Tyler Moore, Single Woman, and we also saw One Day at a Time, where there was a single mom with two kids. So television also was, we were really engaged in maybe we weren't all living the wildlife, and there's a chapter on that as well. I mean, we think about Deep Throat, and we think about the sex going on in clubs, but back home in our living rooms, we were trying out vicariously, perhaps, you know, something different.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even on All in the Family, even Archie and Edith encountered some swingers. I recall the line that Edith said to Archie, "I believe, Archie, that they're AM/FM."
Oh, yeah.
Which, of course, is an old technology in a way now. People don't think about that, but... that obviously problems were being addressed, at least to the extent that television can. The single mothers and so forth always seemed to have better houses or apartments than they probably could afford.
Yeah, yeah. Also, there was Saturday Night Live, which was, I don't know, was maybe following a little bit in the laugh-in mode, but very... you know, riotous in terms of, you know, another, you know, poke in the eye to authority.
You know, absolutely. And of course, one of the things that I find interesting about Saturday Night Live is that their young stars were called the not ready for primetime players. And that was, in a way, the situation that a lot of baby boomers were in. That they were educated, they were out, they wanted to be autonomous, but somehow or other there was this sense, because the labor market was so crowded, that people felt that they couldn't be they weren't ready for prime time. Of course, we know that not ready for prime time players became, for the most part, pretty big stars.
Yeah, yeah. Thomas Hine is our guest this afternoon, writer and critic Thomas Hine. His latest book, The Great Funk, Falling Apart and Coming Together on a Shag Rug in the 70s. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The Great Funk is a very visual book, and it reminds me of how the decade was really riotous in terms of color and texture. Was that an extension of the 60s?
Well, certainly the colors that that we associate with the 70s began to emerge in the 60s, that the 60s kind of visually was a very brief time because the kind of visual culture of the 50s actually lasted well into the 60s. And then in the early 60s, we got a lot of very cool and metallic and technological look. And suddenly the technology and the coolness, the idea that you could fine-tune everything, the economy, and manage a war and do so many things at once. And, you know, the slogan of that is, if we can go to the moon, we can, and then fill in the blank. Mm. Solve poverty, you know, feed the hungry, do, you know, everything that you can think of. And so what started to happen is that the 70s colors, which tended to be earth tones and tended to be kind of a little bit dirty colors and a little warm, and started to come in the late 60s. And then what happened in the 70s is this incredible density of things, that people were trying to salvage everything from the past. They were trying to create very sheltering spaces, and so the textures just became everything became far more tactile, and the number of items that you would have in a room probably tripled or quadrupled.
Mm-hmm. That's why we have the shag rug and the velour shirt and so on and so forth. Well, let's take a call now. We've got a listener who's waiting for us in Savoy on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. I'm enjoying the program quite a bit. I'm in my 50s and went to school and college during the 70s. I remember the 70s as a time of incredibly bad clothes. But I do have an interesting story. Hopefully it's interesting to relate to you about the 70s, and then I'll go ahead and ring off. Went to school at a private college, western suburbs of Chicago. For some reason or another, for a pastime, the kids used to climb the walls, literally climb the walls, heaped one on top of another. Okay, so that's fine. So fast forward to 2004, and my wife and I took the kids to our obligatory Disney World trip. Pop Century is the resort, and various centuries, decades, the 50s, Elvis Presley, Marilyn Monroe, 60s, pictures of JFK. Checking in over the 70s, and here's this same picture of my college buddies climbing the walls from the 70s at a private college in the western suburbs of Chicago. And, of course, I was very excited about that. I couldn't believe it. And, of course, the clerk, who was 25, I think, thought maybe I had lobsters coming out of my ears. And anyway, I sent the picture to the Alumni Association. The press picked it up, and lo and behold, about a year ago, they interviewed me, and the story ran in the newspaper. Why the kids decided to climb the walls or what that signified, I have no idea, but it was very bizarre. Seeing it 35 years later at a Walt Disney resort. Anyway, a little story to entertain you with. Very good show. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. What do you make of that, Tom Hine?
Well, I guess maybe because it was at a Walt Disney resort, they couldn't show Streakers, which was the great college and elsewhere fad of the 70s. Though, oddly enough, it's difficult to find good photographs of Streakers.
Really?
Yeah, because the premise is that they're sort of coming out of nowhere, or else you have things that were organized streaks of about 500 people running at once, and they tend to be bad. They tend to be bad pictures. Mm. I don't know. I would have thought there would have been thousands of pictures of Streakers, and I couldn't find them.
What was that streaking thing all about?
Well, I think it was about being kind of rambunctious and disruptive. You know, it's just this sort of pretty simple. But, you know, one of the things I discuss in the book is this whole celebration of the body that comes during that period, and the fact that NASA even sent nude pictures into outer space was you know, characteristic of the era, that people became much more comfortable with their bodies or inclined to celebrate their bodies. And it may be because that we had never in our history had more young people just becoming adults and being kind of so proud of their bodies.
Mm. And this thing that the caller mentioned about climbing the walls, was that something that was going on, or was that something that was just going on at his?
I think that that's a subculture. That's a new one to me.
Oh. You have so many photos in this book. Speaking of photos of streakers, there is a nice photo of Streaker in the book.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, but tell us about writing the book, about designing it, about making the choices in terms of the images that are included here.
Well, I followed the same procedure in writing with Populex, which is that I wanted to write what I meant and then find the pictures, because otherwise there's the temptation to write the book from one picture to the next, and then you don't have anything that really hangs together.
Yeah.
And the 70s are so chaotic in some ways anyway, that there's so much, you know, so much easier to write about the 50s, because there was sort of one, although obviously there were dissenters that are important, but there was sort of one line of mainstream society. And what happened in the 70s is that things went off into any number of directions. And I realized that in a so short a book, I wasn't going to be able to represent every single one of them fairly. So I invite people, this is a 70s idea, okay, if it's missing, then write your own book. But I wanted the thing to be coherent, to say what I wanted to say. And then I spent a lot of time finding pictures that don't, some of which stand alone, some of which are unsupported, you know, by text, but which also tell a parallel story, tell the same story. So in other words, you can browse the book looking at the pictures, and you can probably get a lot of the points that I'm making, but I wanted the history and the narrative to drive the pictures rather than the other way around.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the copy is really good. I think it's very well done, and I think it can't be all-inclusive. The 70s were so schizophrenic in a way.
Yeah, but, and you find yourself using some shorthand. I mean, some of the reviews have been about reviewers sort of thinking what they thought was important about this, how they felt and what they experienced in the 70s and what I left out. Or in some cases, when you try to put too much in, you oversimplify in a way that gets people really angry.
Yeah. Well, trying to introduce this program today was kind of a challenge for me, because there was so much going on, and you want to kind of remind people, you want to spark their memory if they lived through it, or if they didn't live through it, but maybe they might have read some of this in history books or whatnot. You kind of want to, you know, you want to hit some things. I would describe the book maybe as a book-long think piece, but it is done in a number of essays. Would that be fair?
I think that's fair. I mean, to me, from my point of view, the heart of the book is probably the chapters that deal with the body and with fashion and people's houses and interiors.
Yeah.
But all of that doesn't make sense to me, at any rate, without looking at the society as a whole and the sense of scarcity. I mean, I remember getting calls from an aged aunt saying, "Everything, we're running out of everything. There's no toilet paper. I can't make your favorite cake because there are no raisins." there was a raisin panic, you know, little remembered thing. I don't think it got into the book, but there was a meat shortage. That there was this period, especially in 1972 and 1973, when there was this social panic about running out of everything. And it started, believe it or not, before the 1973 oil crisis.
Talk with us about that panic. What fueled that? No pun intended.
Well, it actually started as a started kind of in your territory, and in the that in the grain belt, because there was a failure of all things. I mean, the Soviet Union was our mortal enemy, but they had a crop failure, and a great amount of American grain was sent to the Soviet Union, and farmers did, I think, quite well that year. Made the price of beef rise tremendously, and so farmers chose not to raise their cattle so much because the price of feed was up so much. So there was a beef shortage, and that was the beginning of all of these this period of shortage. And then, of course, it became far worse in 1973 with the Yom Kippur War and the Middle East oil embargo against the United States.
Yeah.
And then that was worsened still by the decision to have alternate day gasoline sales, so that people were lining up to, even if they didn't need gas, to fill up your tank on Wednesday, because if you don't get it on Wednesday, you won't get any until Friday.
Yeah, and the thermostat had to go either up or down. If it was winter, it had to go down, and if it was summer, the AC thermostat had to be set much higher.
Yes, that's true. And of course, then later we had Jimmy Carter wearing sweaters to set an example for us. But that ended up, because of Carter became less popular, that ended up as a kind of joke.
Yeah, there was a meat boycott in there somewhere as well.
Yes, there
wasn't
was. And I didn't deal with it in the book, and I can't tell you enough about it right now off the top of my head.
Sure, that's okay.
Well, it was mostly had to do with the high prices that I was talking about earlier.
Yeah, and then we had the campaign, and was this the 70s? It's been a while now. The Wendy's campaign that led into a political campaign, Where's the Beef?
Oh, that's later.
That's later, okay.
But one of the oddest was the toilet paper shortage that a senator speaking on the floor of the Senate, or actually it was a congressman, said, "I hope that with all these shortages, we don't have a toilet paper shortage, because that's something that touches us all." And a night or two later, Johnny Carson on the Tonight Show made a joke about it, and what happened was that people went running, that they thought the whole thing was serious, and so the toilet paper shortage came completely out of panic that there is a toilet paper shortage. People ran to the supermarkets and hoarding
toilet paper.
Mm-hmm.
Bizarre. Thomas Hine is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about the 1970s. Thomas Hine is the author most recently of The Great Funk, Falling Apart and Coming Together on a Shag Rug in the 70s. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, the first caller that we've had this afternoon mentioned bad clothes, and you have a chapter in the book, The Great Funk, Nights in Green Dacron. And earlier you mentioned how in the 70s things could have a technological kind of a look, but also it was kind of we were also interested in handmade or homemade.
Yeah, actually, I was comparing it to the 60s, when there was more of a technological look, whereas in the 70s, everything became more handmade, more folky, more crafty, more funky. You know, a funky find as furniture, or even people started wearing vintage clothing, and especially ethnic ethnic folkish clothing, you know, with not necessarily any specific origin, but looking kind of unfinished and looking hand stitched and so forth, even if it wasn't.
Yeah, macrame and granny glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's take another call now. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello there.
Yes. I heard somebody say that Jimmy Carter wore a sweater during the crisis of the heat. And I wonder why that is a joke.
Well, it isn't really. I mean, the problem was that this was the second oil crisis of 1979.
Correct.
And by the time that was happening, I guess retrospectively it was seen as a joke because what happened, this we haven't gotten to this and probably will, but that the 70s ended very abruptly. It was as if it was completely, you know, I call it deliverance and denial, that with the election of Ronald Reagan, we put all of the worries of the 70s behind us, whether we should have or not. One of the first things that Ronald Reagan did was remove solar collectors from the roof of the White House that Carter had installed as to set an example of environmentalism. And Reagan was sort of saying, we don't need to do that. We're powerful. We don't need to look dependent. And so the same thing holds true. The president wearing a sweater was viewed as a sort of a sign of weakness, of something less than manly.
Should that be a weakness?
Well, I'm not saying it should. I'm saying that that's how it was perceived.
Oh.
I wear sweaters all the time.
Yeah.
Myself.
I do, too. And I keep my furnace down at night at 60.
I like sweaters a lot.
Wearing a sweater is not a joke.
It's not a joke per se, but it's just.
Well, I mean, what happened was that Carter himself began to be perceived as weak, and
just because
the sweater
he wore
was
a sweater?
No, not just because he wore a sweater,
but the sweater was a part of that phenomenon.
Okay, I do understand that he was seen as weak. I do not believe he was weak, but...
No, I am an admirer of Jimmy Carter myself, but I am just sort of trying to describe some of the attitudes of the period. I mean, there was an incident in which he went fishing, and he seemed to have been attacked by a rabbit, and this became... this became a big joke as well.
Yeah.
In a way, I mean, that this is a part of this whole anti-authoritarian spirit of the 70s, that Gerald Ford was always depicted as a bungler on Saturday Night Live, that Gerald Ford was always falling down a flight of stairs. I mean, Gerald Ford was maybe the best athlete that we've ever had as a president, but he did trip once, and so all that people remember about Gerald Ford is that he was clumsy and he kept falling downstairs.
Yeah. Well, we somehow or other we managed to latch on to something.
Yeah.
And then it sticks.
Mm-hmm.
It sticks. One of the things you laud about the 1970s, the mistrust of authority. Would you talk about what gave rise to the mistrust of authority? I guess largely in part as a result of Watergate and Nixon's resignation. And then what led us since then to be less likely, even unlikely, to question authority?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in a way that the more I thought about it, I mean, the easy answer of the mistrust of authority was because of Nixon, and then I sometimes think that the only reason Nixon got caught was because of an increasing mistrust of authority, that because there was a sort of aura of paranoia that started coming in the late 60s, that made it more likely for people to, you know, questioning the president and what he did, you know, was not something that people ever did, that people had previously done lightly. And, of course, even during the 1972 presidential campaign, the only newspaper that was running stories about Watergate was the Washington Post, and other newspapers weren't picking it up because somehow it seemed unbelievable that there could be so dishonest as an outright burglary being hatched in the White House.
Yeah.
Why since? I think that people would rather not think about the people that we have to trust, the people who control, you know, literally the fate of the world, being dishonest and deeply fallible.
Yeah. And since September 11th, also, I think we've been asked to leave authority alone.
Yes, there's no question about that. That a lot of the freedom that people found during the 70s, we've been asked to give up since September 11th in the name of security. One of the central realities of the 70s was there was no real security. You know, you could even run out of toilet paper, or you know, if you can run out of gas, you can run out of anything
and everything. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Bloomington, Illinois, line one. Hi.
Hi. How are you guys today?
Fine. What can we do for you?
Hi. You know what? I just turned on the radio and caught the piece, and your guest who was explaining, and I just wanted to call in and say how grateful I am to hear somebody say, to temper that whole idea of that the reason for the mistrust was solely, as it's usually placed, on the government's failures and certainly what the Nixon administration did in the burglaries. But that it was tempered with, you know, the age and the culture that we lived in, and that sense of paranoia and that sense of outrage and that sense of, you know, the youth of America at the time in the 60s, the counterculture revolution, and who was just based on distrust and, that, you know, that general idea that all adults were bad and doing wrong things anyway. And as I was hearing you say that, and I was going to congratulate you for that, for tempering it like that, I hate to say you went to the other extreme and say that all the liberties that we've gained since the 70s we've now lost after 9/11, and it's kind of those all-encompassing broad strokes and statements that I think would alarm me most from whoever says it, and that's just the comment I wanted to make.
Okay, yeah, maybe we're a little too quick with the shorthand.
Well, I certainly didn't mean to say all. But I think that clearly that's been a trend. So
it's been
I don't be correct.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that again, and I think that maybe for me, one of the interesting discussions that I've had with so many people over the years, and how everybody goes, oh well, you know, they're just so easy to just blame it all on the media. And it's not that, certainly. I think we are all guilty of sometimes exaggerating to make a point, or just for brevity's sake. But it is it's a much larger, more complex question to, you know, just add it up in just one broad statement like that. It's problematic. But, of course, it's the nature of all of us to tend to just categorize things so succinctly, I guess.
Well, and, of course, as I said earlier, that a lot of the, that there was even as early as the election of Ronald Reagan a hunger for authority, somebody that we can could trust, and so
yeah,
I'm not saying
I,
it's all since September 11th.
I mean, I think historically in America we've seen that come and go. I mean, it's not just now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the greater historical perspective, you know, in our culture in particular, but probably in human history, I think we can see periods where, you know, it comes and goes. Now, certainly we now live in a unique time. I just think that, in generally speaking, it's difficult to categorize it, again, so succinctly as to say that, well, since 9/11 we've suffered, you know, it's all going downhill now. You know, well, let's temper that a little bit.
Well, no, I guess I was rendering an opinion that's not really relevant to the book, but I do think that there has been a demonization of the kind of freedoms that people felt in the 70s, and I really would prefer not to lose these mm-hmm. freedoms. And we've, you know, so I am view myself as being a little bit of a contrarian in the culture, saying that the 70s weren't all, yeah, we may look at an old photograph of ourselves with wide lapels and say, oh, why was I doing that? How could I have done that? But also at that time, there was a kind of creativity and freedom in the culture that that we should think twice about before we say it was a mistake.
Yeah. And how have the 70s helped define who we are today? Because it was said, you know, in the 80s, you know, that the decade of the 70s, let's just forget that. But we haven't, and we can't. And
yeah, well, part of, you know, as part of it is reruns.
Yeah, and I'm wearing a new and improved Earth shoe here today, as a matter of fact. So
yeah, and also, I mean, it's one of those things that this idea of there being a single mainstream vision for how people, and this is mostly about, this book is mostly about Americans, about how people in North America should live.
Yeah.
That whole, that's all gone. And, you know, and in many ways, the things that we talk about that in a way are, frankly, are paralyzing our political system, the idea of kind of one issue of voters and the rise of the rise of groups that unite religion and politics in various ways, the general fragmentation and narrowing of interest in our political system is obviously a long-term result of the 70s.
Mm. You mentioned a little bit ago, well, let's take another call, and then I'll save this question. So we've got somebody waiting to talk with you. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Thomas Hine.
Yeah, I have probably about 20 million comments, but I'll keep it real short.
Okay, thanks.
I much preferred the 70s to this decade, but in terms of the Great Society poverty programs and so forth, I think they failed not because they were structurally lack of funding in a war which sapped the funding, but just a little tidbit: in the spring of 1974, if it comes to streakers, there was, I think, four gentlemen jumped out of a plane, streaking all the way down, and landed on the quad on the University of Illinois. And that's, I'll just hang up, but thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. You want to comment on that?
Well, the colleges, of course, were a great center of streaking.
Yeah.
I one of the photos I rejected was sort of, it seems to have been the entire student body, as it were, of Syracuse University streaking. You had an awful lot of things, and there was, I think, North Carolina, and somebody's going to get after me. North Carolina got the Guinness Book of World Records as the most streakers at any one time, and so on.
Now we'll go back to my question that I was about to ask, and that goes back to your comment that the 70s came to an abrupt end, and I think one signal of that was the hostage crisis and then the election of Ronald Reagan. And we talked a little bit about how Jimmy Carter was perceived as weak. And that seems to me fed into the election of Ronald Reagan, and the 70s ended with us in front of the television set watching Ted Koppel.
Right. And it, and for me, it really ended on that, on Inauguration Day, when the screen was split, and on one side are, we see the preparations for the inauguration. On the other side, we see Iran preparing to release the hostages. That it happened the same day, and it was negotiated by people who were to become part of the Reagan administration.
One of the things you say at the close of The Great Funk is that something that we've ignored about the decade is the beginning of stagnation in workers' income and simultaneously our acquisitiveness. And I wonder if I could ask you here for your thoughts about that. Why have we been so acquisitive in light of the state of our wages?
That's something I've been thinking about for years, and have not figured out, to be blunt about it. That, you know, one of the reasons that we haven't felt the stagnation of wages as much is because of a much larger workforce with many more women in it. And the addition, the combination of the baby boom plus a lot younger women who would normally have been not been expected to be in the workforce, helped create the very high unemployment rate that characterized the 1970s. And what has tended to happen is that I think that most women, it's quite certain, and there are statistics on this, that the great majority of women who are working believe that it's economically, it's not just for self-realization, it's because it's economically necessary to do so.
Yeah.
And one reason it's economically necessary to do so is because we have ramped up the expected size of our houses and the number of things to be in the houses and so forth to soak up all of the family income that's there.
Yeah. It's quite a sobering statement you make near the end of the book. Americans have worked longer hours and acquired more possessions displayed in larger houses where nobody is home. So, well, we began this hour with a little bit of disco music from Saturday Night Fever. I thought we would end with a little bit more music, Thomas Hine, and I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. This, for me, was a musical highlight of the decade, Marvin Gaye. And I'm just going to leave it at that. Thomas Hine, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon. Thomas Hine is the author, most recently, of The Great Funk, Falling Apart and Coming Together on a Shag Rug in the 70s. The book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.